Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series. Today we'll be talking to national security expert Major General Gus McLachlan, who retired from the Australian Army in 2018 following a stellar 37-year career. During that time, he was responsible for generating Australian defence capability in cyberspace, electronic warfare, and command and control systems. He's now working in the private sector as Executive General Manager People for Boral, and is also a director and strategic advisor to Australian and US defence, as well as several cyber, space and technology companies. Gus is an adjunct professor at Monash University, where he advises on national security research. Hello, my name's Ron Candlars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. Also in the studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities. Soon she'll be off to Washington leading a delegation to meet with US government officials and the various partners of the Global Research Intensive Universities Network, with defence a key topic. So plenty of defence issues to discuss in today's podcast. Well, firstly to you, Gus McLachlan, there are many geopolitical uncertainties currently facing Australia. Given your remarkable 37-year career in the Army, what do you think Australia must do to build a stronger and more resilient defence capability?
Well, in the first instance, I think we're going to need a whole-of-nation response. And it's one thing to spend money on defence, but if we can't demonstrate resilience across all the elements of national power, I think we're going to struggle to assert ourselves as a nation in these challenging circumstances. We faced, for example, a period of economic coercion over the last sort of 4 or so years where China exercised some significant restrictions on aspects of trade. And I think we've come through that fairly well. So as a nation, when you're looking at the grand security challenge, the first thing is I would say we're going to need the whole of nation to respond. And of course, that has a very particular relationship with our university sector. The challenge for our defence force is the rate of change. And I think we've had a relatively benign period of unipolar leadership, relatively peaceful. And I'm acknowledging that hasn't been a universal peace. But in that period, we've had an ability to probably keep track or keep pace with change. But Moore's law in digital transformation, emergence of a much more confident and assertive China, probably the relative demise of the United States, all of those things are increasing the rate of change for defence decision makers.
Well, you talk about this national resilience. Just like to drill down on that a bit more. I mean, apart from the obvious defence aspects of, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, etc., what other aspects of Australian society do you think need to be considered when looking at that national defence resilience?
Well, I think we all got a shock as a result of the pandemic. And we woke up to the fact that we were reliant on this period of, you know, almost uninterrupted free trade and global movement of goods. We came into this mindset of just-in-time supply chains that would just turn up. We'd click on our Amazon order and our book arrives in the next 24 or 48 hours. The reality, I think, that has been exposed by COVID, but I think by other, strategic shifts. We've got a war in Europe that has significantly disrupted energy supplies, not just into Europe, but around the rest of the world. So I think for everybody, the idea that nations are going to have to go back and work out what is important to be able to do themselves. And, I think the inability, for example, to produce mRNA vaccines in Australia. We know our universities had the research understanding to do that, but we had never mobilised an industrial capacity. And of course, it's not just the vaccine. You need the glass vial that it goes in, and you need the plastic needle to inject it. You need the gloves and the masks to wear whilst you're doing so. We import almost exclusively our liquid energy resources from Singapore, and we have, somewhere between 7 and 14 days of stock holding, for example. We're reliant on connection to the world through a series of internet cables and access to space. And all of those things, I think we're now more aware, able to be disrupted. We could be coerced through access to those things. And I think we're all going to have to work out as a nation strategically what we need to do. Now, in the defence area, for example, the so-called smart munitions, and these are munitions that have very precise targeting in order to reduce things like civilian casualties. They very precisely hit their target. The Western world has effectively run out of their stockholdings of those just supporting the war in Ukraine. So if we want to have access to that level of precision and technology, then we have to think about how much of that we need to produce ourselves in Australia.
And do you think we're up for that challenge?
I'm going to be realistic rather than pessimistic. I think we have an opportunity to move quite quickly, but it's going to take some seriously concerted and organised national effort. I think the new government's arrival and consideration in this space has been very mature, and it's the combination of diplomatic efforts in our region by Foreign Minister Wong, you know, in order to essentially try and reduce tension, increase our partnerships, maintain our relationships with regional peers. So on the one level, we want to prevent war. And on the other level, we want to create a national capacity that says to other countries, we're very difficult to coerce. We're relatively independent, and we do have some ability to defend ourselves by causing, you know, some level of damage to somebody who might want to attack us. And that then equals deterrence. Now, I think we've got a long way to go. So there are a number of big shifts. Of course, we've heard the submarine announcement. A lot of people are, you know, unsure why we would need to spend, you know, $300 billion of our hard-earned money while we've got other challenges, you know, NDIS underfunding, you know, GPs asking for more money, aging population, underpaid workers in the care sector, et cetera. So for a government, these are very difficult issues to balance. I'm optimistic that we have, and again, without being kind of a bit trite, I think we've got a pretty adult conversation going on. And I think the importance of this is probably recognised by most participants in the political process.
This is also happening at the time that, you know, in soon to be announced, there'll be the Defence Strategic Review. So all of what you're talking about sits around that particular issue. So we've got some massive decisions to be making in the weeks and months ahead.
Yeah, I really look forward to seeing what Angus Houston and Stephen Smith have come up with, because this is an enormous issue to wrap your arms around in a relatively short amount of time. You know, they have to take the whole of the defence spending plan, which encompasses everything from remote bases in the far northwest of Australia, you know, emerging space capabilities, emerging cyber capabilities, the general need to run the enterprise systems, which to be honest are fairly old, the ICT systems, and the estate in defence is getting fairly old. And then, you know, they have to decide whether we've actually configured our defence force for the challenge that is in front of us. And some people are arguing that we were sort of postured for this generic set of operations. You know, some people called it the balanced force, which was a little bit of everything that could go off to the Middle East in Army's case to chase the Taliban or ISIL, and in Air Force and Navy's case to operate closer to home. There's a view now that the threat is much more specific, and it is the emergence of, you know, the re-emergence of a superpower in our region that is increasingly confident and assertive. So, you know, for a relatively short review to position ourselves as to how to respond, that I think is going to be quite a significant task. And it's not going to be easy to implement. I think the next thing we will hear, the strategic review announced probably later this month. And then, of course, the budget will follow a few weeks later. And it's one thing to have a strategy, but unless you resource it, you know, it's really a fantasy. So that is going to be the challenge for the new government, along with all of the other pressures that are on the budget and their approach. You know, is this, let's call it a magnet, has dropped in a box of iron filings, which is this sort of strategic security challenge.
The scale almost seems somewhat overwhelming, doesn't it? When you put it like that, and a lot of the conversations that we have are around building, you know, sovereign capability, but we don't really have the ability to build purely sovereign capability. We have to do it with our partners, stating the obvious. And yeah, obviously the AUKUS agreement is but one part of that, We've got the Quad and we've got other multilateral agreements. Where do you see the role of, in my case, for example, with our universities, we invest around $70 million in defence R&D, which is about half of the total. So there's obviously an opportunity to scale up there. But again, we can't do it on our own either. And I'm just wondering where you see those opportunities and whether those opportunities are actually acknowledged and recognised by government as being part of that sort of huge scale that you've talked about.
Yeah, Vicky, I think this is the issue that is confronting all of our decision makers. And, you know, look, I am confident that we've got experienced, capable people looking at this. The rate of change, I think, is probably the sort of shock to the system. It's one thing to have clever people, but the processes and systems are relatively antiquated. They're built for a much calmer time. You know, it takes 7 or 8 years to deliver a major defence capability. So I think we've got good people looking at it, but we've just had this situation where, you know, Mr. Peaver, a prominent leader from industry, was asked to do an innovation review under the previous government. Of course, we can't see that now because we work for the previous government. It's been released in a redacted form. You know, all of these are examples of this kind of the clunky nature of our bureaucratic response. So we have to do better, and I'm not sure what you know, we can do other than have the conversations like we are now and engage the brightest and best people, many of whom are in the university sector. Your point about not being able to do this on our own is key. So, you know, I think we've got to put our hand up where we have areas of expertise and add into that system. I'm really pleased to see some recent national efforts around critical minerals, for example, where we have a very significant resource. And if that is channeled more effectively, we can sort of rebalance access to some of those. I'd love us to see us getting into the smart munitions capability and production so that we're not completely reliant on others. But even that suite of systems, we wouldn't be able to achieve ourselves. So I think we're going to need very clever investment in certain areas where we contribute into a global system. And we're going to need friends and partners that bring us access to the best technology. And of course, this is where AUKUS comes in. The universities, I think, are doing a pretty good job, Vicky. And on one level, though, I still feel like our leading universities, our research universities, are one of the untapped resources to accelerate our competitiveness. Now, I don't mean they're completely untapped, but I mean I probably should have said underutilized. Mm-hmm. If we can better mobilise that research through the development of kind of prototypes and get a partnership with industry, I think we can accelerate the take up of some of these advanced technologies. I mean, Tier 2 in AUKUS talks about, you know, undersea sensing capability, quantum AI and autonomy, advanced cyber capabilities, hypersonics. These are topics that our leading research universities have some very considerable expertise in. So the question is, can we create a national conversation, yeah, Vicky, of leaders who can coordinate our effort into that?
And just to unpick that, and we do have significant capability in those areas, as you said, and just to go to that pillar two, there was a report from the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, which I think came out just in the last couple of days, which looks at how Australia and the US can reap greater returns on their investments in shared science and technology if they focus on their shared deterrent objectives. And interestingly, though, they say there are some challenges with that because even though the US is seen as a significant ally and, you know, underpinning our AUKUS agreement, it does carry with it some risk of having that shared knowledge, first of all, used in nefarious ways. But also even sharing it with our own allies is also sometimes challenging. One of the things that I'm finding, and this is really interesting, as we've said at the top of the podcast, I'm going to Washington next week. In my discussions with my university counterparts, both from the UK and the US, AUKUS is not front of mind for them. And I have also had discussions with people within our own government, within our own sort of security areas, Rory Medcalf, who I know we're hoping to have in a podcast very soon, who basically confirmed what I had been sort of picking up, is that when we're talking to them at this level, I'm talking at university level, I'm obviously not talking at that, the sort of, you know, government level, it's just not on their radar in the same way. Mm-hmm. Pillar two, which is underpinned as a science and technology agreement, you know, I think our universities, we're really ready and up for the challenge, but we can't do it on our own, and we need to leverage those relationships that we have with our US and UK universities. So I feel I'm going to be pushing the proverbial a little bit up the hill when I'm talking to my counterparts. So any advice you've got on that? But I'd be interested to know whether you are picking up that same kind of perception, if you like, from our US and UK counterparts in that way.
Yeah, Vicky, definitely. The US side in particular, the US is a behemoth. Of course, we have one United States in our lives. They have a number of, let's call them Australias in their lives. They've got very close relationships with the UK, South Korea, the Philippines, Japan, and so on. So to have AUKUS reach this level of engagement, including with the president and the release, potential release, because we haven't had congressional sign-off yet, but potential release of the most advanced nuclear propulsion secrets is a significant achievement in itself and does point to Australia's sort of status as a pretty close and trusted friend in Washington. But more broadly, we are seeing a very slow rate of awareness and trickle down. We have our long-standing friends in Washington who are always in there advocating for us, but this is taking time. I think the first meaningful objective that we will look for to see if this is making a change is a reduction or release of what's called the ITAR restrictions, the International Trade in Arms Regulations. And these are US laws that are very tightly control the release of US technology. Now, I think I call it good ITAR and bad ITAR. Good ITAR is when you absolutely must keep your nation's secrets to give yourself an advantage. That's sensible. But there's bad ITARs where individual congressmen or congresspeople from, you know, particular areas with parochial interests have used ITAR as a kind of weapon to lock out, you know, opportunities for collaboration. I think we're looking for ITARs to be released and removed, and that will accelerate the engagement at the sensitive level. So organizations like DARPA, their Advanced Research Office, the Office of Naval Research and others that are already doing partnership agreements with our universities, I think we'll be freer for that sort of engagement. But Vicky, it's going to take some noise and effort and advocacy. They're a big behemoth. It's very bureaucratic. And of course, the United States pride themselves on being slow to change as a defense mechanism. The UK is a little bit different. I think they are probably seized by the urgency in a similar way to us. Frankly, their defense force is almost broke. And so I think they see opportunities in this that may be, you know, an easier path to follow initially, but it is going to take work on both sides.
Well, I'll certainly be trying to make some noise while we're over there.
When we talk about, you know, pillar two and the high end, you know, leading science, et cetera, does it point to the idea then that maybe within the Australian university system there should be some centralised academy that brings all these brains together on these big projects? Is that something to consider long term?
Well, there's two parts, of course, to all of this. There's the human capacity building, and I guess that talks to the education component of our universities. And then there's the research component, which is, you know, how do we accelerate our understanding of different technologies? And by the way, it's not just the technical aspects. I think there's a whole discussion to have on the social sciences around laws of armed conflict and autonomy and, you know, engagement in the Asia Pacific. So this isn't just a guns and radars sort of discussion. It's a whole of society discussion. But I think if we take those two parts separately, I think, Vicky, I've heard you say previously that we are, I think, second lowest in the OECD for education of engineers. We've had an addiction to importing engineering talent. You know, we simply have to start turning that around, and that's going to take coordinated effort. I think there is going to need to be collaborations in the research area, so clumps of universities coming together, because our customer in this case, the government and the Department of Defense, are incredibly busy, and they can't broker these individual little agreements and pull it together at their level. They want us to clump these things up at our level get the best of class researchers together, get collaborations together and bring them solutions. So grand challenges, mm-hmm. you know, like hypersonics and the detection and defeat of hypersonics, you know, the AI and quantum, these are not issues or things that individual universities or individual researchers are going to be able to solve themselves. And I think, you know, you probably know better than me, but increasingly it's cross-discipline solutions that bring together elements of these that will solve the problem. So the customer needs our help. They need us to clump together. They need us to help coordinate. They need us to bring, you know, more developed solutions, probably higher up the technical readiness level than perhaps some researchers have been comfortable with in the past, you know, where they want to do just, you know, theoretical research, and applied research has probably been seen as something of a lesser cousin. I think we're going to need to reevaluate a whole range of those sort of discussions.
So, I mean, it really is yet another challenge on the list of challenges, because universities, we are good at collaborating, we do collaborate, but I think you've raised a really good point about, first of all, the multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary reach that we need, because you also have to bring our own Australian community on board with this as well. So there's a kind of social dynamic to that, and a lot of research which would be underway with that. The workforce piece, I mean, you raise, for example, engineering. In 2019, we graduated more international students as our engineers than we did domestic. So we don't have a domestic pipeline of engineers. And if we're talking about sovereign capability, we really need to build that pipeline. So then you're talking about actually going back into schools. So to your point, I guess, Gus, it is a whole of nation exercise that I hope that we are all up for, because I'm not sure that potentially we realise just how big the task is.
Yeah, look, I completely agree, and I think it can get overwhelming. I hope that the new government and others are not overwhelmed. I think it was Jack Welch at GE that said, you know, strategy in the real world is just do stuff and try and make it work. And I think if we continue the sort of efforts that we're starting to see, but perhaps with a, you know, slightly accelerated emphasis, I think we can make really significant progress. We'll never be perfect, but it's the sort of challenge that excites me, frankly, about, you know, this phase of my career now is how can we all, you know, quite experienced people coming together, help advance these things. And it's, you know, great to have this conversation on your podcast, because these are exactly the sort of things we need to be talking about.
Did you have a role in the Defence Strategic Review?
No, I didn't. I did cheekily offer, but I think Air Marshal Houston and Mr. Smith were more than capable of managing without me. But I think it's what I have been involved in is providing a number of written inputs. So where we, where the people I'm collaborating with felt that there was a need to give them a submission, I think the best way to do is participate. So I've been part of three different submissions. You know, one is capacity building. You know, one is around the making sure that we don't lose track of the people and the enterprise systems while we chase the exotic technologies at the front. Etc. So the best way to be, if you're going to commentate on these things, I always feel it's best to make sure you're participating where you have the opportunity.
But you, with your 37-year career, you'd be well placed. And I was reading, you know, at one point you were a commander leading 35,000 men and women. You've got a fair handle on what's required to, you know, look after Australia's defence. But I just wanted to run by you a couple of numbers that put this into some perspective as the review draws ever near. As of December 2022, the ADF had a shortfall of 3,000 people, with the department 1,000 under its budgeted capacity. Not included in this statistic, the Australian government estimates that AUKUS will support another 20,000 over the next 30 years across the ADF, the public service and the private industry. So it begs the question, where are all these people going to come from?
That is the million-dollar question, in my opinion. The submarines and technology are important, but if you can't crew them, and if you can't, fill these advanced jobs in cybersecurity, Minister Claire O'Neill's doing some fantastic work confronting the threat we face in cybersecurity. I've read some open source intelligence that says we're up to the fourth most attacked country in cyberspace. Which when you think about it, there's a war going on in Europe where at least a couple of countries are going hard at it. To be in the top, whatever number it is, but around the top four is a really significant threat. You know, we're going to have to address this again as a nation. Full-time regular service in our military may not be attractive to everybody. We may need partnerships with industry. We may need greater use of reserves. I made a comment in a separate podcast the other day that I can foresee a circumstance where somebody in a wheelchair with access to, you know, the internet may be more capable of damaging an enemy air defence network using cyber tools than a platoon of able-bodied people might be elsewhere. So I think it's going to take a really, you know, lateral thinking about how our nation can come together and solve these problems. The traditional way of assessing someone's suitability for defence, well, they could pass a fitness test, which means they could march up a hill with a pack on their back. They had no criminal record. They had an education, you know, up to year 12. There's a whole range of things which actually restrict your access to the available talent in your country. We're going to have to relook at all of those things. And I think one of the exciting things looking at the education component in university is very similar. You know, we've had 3-year bachelor's degrees as the foundation of our university structure. But if you now look at a workforce where young hackers might just get experience, you know, hacking in their bedroom, they might then go, you know, into a business and be on the tools in the cybersecurity area of one of our telcos, et cetera, no formal training. Can we give them some micro-credentials with some core elements that a university might insist on as being part of a tertiary degree, but then build a new system of pulling some of these exciting people through our education system, you know, eventually leading into masters and PhDs, but off a completely untraditional entry pathway. And one of my passions is military veteran employment. We have a suicide royal commission going on led by Nick Caldas, where, you know, we're learning that some defence veterans who leave the military before they had hoped to, usually through injury, feel like they're kind of dumped on society with no skills. Well, wouldn't it be fantastic if we could pull them through a process of recognising their certificate-style education, building some credentials and leading them back into our more formal education process. So it's going to take all these kind of lateral ideas to get the people together we need to solve these problems.
And all of that, I think, is eminently doable. You know, we need to be creative, and we're nothing if not creative in our universities. And the idea of micro-credentials, which is obviously we offer micro-credentials, but making them so that it's sort of stackable, as you quite rightly say, so that you can come in and out as you need. Because I think there is this untapped resource out there that we're not actually pulling through. And the idea of a traditional 3-year degree and a couple of years honours and then a PhD might be attractive to some, but actually we've got to get our skates on and start moving a lot more quicker in that area. I just want to, if I can, just take you to something which I'm really keen to get your views on. You talked earlier on in the podcast around sort of some of the clunky nature of policy regimes, et cetera. One of the things that we've been looking at the Group of Eight, and it wasn't actually just in the context of AUKUS, it was more in the context of sensitive research and technology pre-COVID, is how do we actually encourage fluidity of movement, if you like, of people across a different domain? Mm. So, you know, a PhD who's working in hypersonics in a university in the UK who might be able to come to Australia but can also work in the US on the same project. And one of the ideas and one of the proposals was, I'm now calling it an AUKUS visa, and we've talked about that previously, but we come up with the idea prior to that, of course. I mean, how realistic do you think it is that we could actually come up with a security clearance process across the 3 countries in sensitive areas to actually accelerate some of this research? I mean, are we being a bit naive to think we can, or do you think it's something that we could feasibly pursue?
No, you're not being naive in assuming that we can and should. And fortunately, that same question has come up in defence industry. Just last night I was at an industry networking event where a former British officer with very high-level security clearances was telling me those security clearances are not recognised here. So it's not just in the research area. It's in a range of areas, and we have to do better than that. The ITAR restriction that I talked about is an example of that. If the countries can agree that people operating inside this, let's call it the AUKUS bubble, you could probably argue the old Five Eyes bubble, which would bring in Canada and New Zealand as well. I tell you a story, Vicky, which is not going to make you feel any better. But I was a very good friend of mine was at a briefing in Hawaii about a particular topic and was asked to leave the room because the security briefing was what the US considered no foreign. And before he left, he said, look, on this topic, I suspect that you will find that the author is probably Australian. And they said, well, how would you know that? And he said, because I think I wrote this report. And it turns out that the intelligence that they were about to present, he had written and had been passed into the Five Eyes network. And in that process had been deemed so sensitive it was only accessible to Americans in this particular audience. So that just shows the silliness of this relationship, which is being worked through. But I think the universities and industry and our defence leadership all have to work with government together to solve this problem, because what is needed is exactly what you describe.
So overall, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the capacity to confront some of these big defence issues in the short term?
Or realistic?
Realistic, yeah.
I think I'm realistic. I'm optimistic in the sense that I think Australia is an incredibly creative, innovative country where we are pretty good when we sort of need to turn our minds to things to solve problems. Frankly, while we beat up on ourselves, I think our national response to COVID is a great example of when we sort of put our shoulders to the wheel, so to speak, that we can respond in a pretty positive way, and the results speak for themselves in terms of deaths and so on. But I think it's going to take that level of national engagement. Now, what is missing, and I'll be completely honest, is the old-fashioned political and policy conversations where these things are explained to the people of Australia and explained why they are so important and why they may need to have to change or sacrifice in order to achieve something. And I think back to the floating of the dollar and the banking deregulation, and I think we've got to go back to those days where we could have conversations with our population and explain the importance of things. Now, one of the threats I think we all face, frankly, the biggest threat to democracy, in my opinion, is not an attack on Taiwan. It's the polarization of democracies through misinformation in social media and other forums. So how do we get back into that space and see and hear from our leaders and be told why is a nuclear submarine important? I don't think the Australian people are fully convinced yet. And yes, it's sensitive because in some ways you have to describe missions that might, specifically describe a potential adversary. But boy, if we can't work our way through this, when a voter or somebody is out there thinking about what they think the priorities should be, they've got lots of other priorities that they are looking for us to consider at the moment. So communicate.
Why do you think that is, though? Why have, in more recent times, governments had a paternalistic or patronising attitude towards the Australian public about some of the biggest issues that confront them?
I think if we could solve that in this discussion, we'd be really back to... firstly, I think we've got to value our democracy. One of the organisations I'm most proud of, and now we're getting really philosophical, right, is the Australian Electoral Commission. We've got to understand that we have these incredible organisations and pillars and traditions. I think the Electoral Commission's defence of misinformation during the most recent election was world class. And I think we sort of got to build out from valuing what it is we have, explained to people who, my kids have grown up in an almost uninterrupted period of economic growth, relative geopolitical stability. We had a period there where we were flip-flopping prime ministers a bit, but, in the broad, we've got a lot of our young people, have not experienced the sort of adversity that potentially is emerging now. Putin's illegal invasion into Ukraine, I think if that didn't kickstart the sort of shock that there are still people and regimes out there that still believe force and brutality are legitimate element of international engagement. And we've got to be very careful in the West. I participated in two military engagements, let's call one of them, an invasion. And so, we've got to be able to have these conversations and explain why, a unipolar world with a strong United Nations with reinforcing the importance of democracy is important, because the alternative is pretty grim.
We'll leave it there, Gus, but big, big issues. Maybe we'll have to get you back after the review to chat about them at greater length again. But thank you very much for your time today.
No, look, my pleasure. And, our leading universities are central to Australia's competitiveness, and the innovation and creativity we have there excites me, and I'd love to see more of it mobilised in our defence and national security area.
Thanks, Gus. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to the debate at go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.